the headlines. The Taliban capture Lashkargah in southwestern Afghanistan as the U.S. and Britain deploy thousands of troops to the country to evacuate their nationals. China rejects the World Health Organization's calls for a new probe into the origins of COVID-19, saying it supports scientific over political efforts to find out how the virus started. Russia reports 815 new deaths from the coronavirus, recording its highest daily fatality since the start of the pandemic. Welcome to the program. Taliban militants say they have captured Lashkargah, the capital of Helmand province in southern Afghanistan. A security source has confirmed the news, saying military and government officials have had evacuated Lashkargah after striking a deal with the Taliban. The militants have seized over a dozen provincial capitals since last Friday as they press ahead with their offensive across Afghanistan. The group is estimated to be in control of nearly two-thirds of the country. The capital, Kabul, remains in the hands of the government. Thousands of civilians have already fled there as the Taliban took key cities one by one. Meanwhile, the U.S. and U.K. say they are deploying thousands of troops to help evacuate their nationals and diplomats leaving Afghanistan. Our correspondent in Kabul, Amin Alemi, gives us more details about the Taliban taking control of provincial capitals in Afghanistan.
The situation is worsening. The insecurity is worsening day by day in Afghanistan due to the expansion of Taliban attacks across this country. Based on official reports, Lashkargah, the capital city of the southern Helmand province of Afghanistan, is under the control of Taliban militants, and the Taliban could capture this strategic city in southern Afghanistan after weeks of fightings with Afghan security forces, especially commando troops who were stationed there. Prior to the collapse of the Lashkargah, or the capital of Helmand province in southern Afghanistan, the commander of 2015 Afghan National Army Corps, General Sadat, was responsible for security of not only the city of Lashkargah, but also for the entire province, as well as for the province of Nimruz. In the meantime, the Taliban also claims to have captured the Lugar district, located in southwest of Kabul, according to Taliban spokesman. The Taliban militants have entered the city of Pule Alam, the center of the capital of this province, that is located very close to the Afghan capital, Kabul. In the meantime, Ghazni, another strategic city that is located 150 kilometers south of Kabul, is also under the control of the Taliban, and the Taliban has only made on Wardak province on the way to reach to Kabul.
Iran has called on the Taliban to ensure the safety of diplomats and diplomatic facilities in the Afghan city of Herat. The call followed a Taliban announcement that they have gained control over the city. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said that his country is in regular contact with its consulate in Herat and follows up the condition of the staff there. Said Khatibzadeh also expressed concern about the escalation of violence in Afghanistan and the condition of civilians. He urged the Taliban to ensure their safety. Herat is Afghanistan's third largest city and fell to the Taliban Thursday. Iranians have reacted to the release of a photo of the Russian and British ambassadors in Tehran. In this report, we will tell you why the picture has triggered an acrimonious backlash.
A controversial photo taken at the Russian embassy in Tehran has angered Iranians. The picture posted online by the Russian embassy this week has drawn widespread criticism and growing calls for an official apology. The controversial photo depicts Russian Ambassador Levan Jagarian and his British counterpart Simon Shercliffe sitting on the porch of the embassy with a third empty chair. It clearly echoes a photo taken in 1943 of Allied leaders Joseph Stalin, Winston Churchill, and U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt at exactly the same location. The Allied leaders met at the Tehran conference to coordinate strategy against Nazi Germany. At the time, Iran was occupied by Russian and British forces, despite its neutrality in the Second World War. The 1943 conference at the Russian embassy is seen by many Iranians as a violation of Iran's sovereignty and independence. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, led a chorus of sharp criticism, describing the photo as, quote, extremely inappropriate. On Thursday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the British and Russian envoys over the release of the picture online. The envoys were told at the ministry that the posting was totally unacceptable. The Russian and British diplomats insist that no harm was intended and that the picture was a tribute to the fight against Nazi Germany.
The tweet posting the picture received a large number of angry replies. Some said the ambassadors are insulting all Iranians. Outgoing Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif criticized the posting, saying the Iranian people have shown that their destiny can never be subject to decisions in foreign embassies or by foreign powers.
Other Iranian officials and people were quick to denounce the photo. Iran's parliament speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf censored the meeting between the Russian and UK ambassadors as, quote, inappropriate and inconsistent with diplomatic protocols, urging the foreign ministry to follow up on the case. Ghalibaf said both ambassadors must swiftly issue an official apology, otherwise firm diplomatic action will be necessary. Foreign Minister-designate Hossein Amir Abdullahian joined the chorus of critics on Thursday. The top diplomat said the picture, quote, showed disregard for diplomatic etiquette and the national pride of the Iranian people. Faced with widespread criticism, the Russian ambassador tweeted that the photo does not have any anti-Iranian context. The envoy said that he is not going to offend the feelings of the friendly Iranian people. The British ambassador retweeted his Russian counterpart's comments. The controversy triggered by the photo is still under the spotlight. Some observers believe an official apology could help end the controversy.
Palestinians have condemned Israel's plans for building over 2,000 new settler units in the occupied West Bank. Earlier in our news review program, I discussed that issue with our guests. The Palestinian president strongly condemns Israeli plans to build over 2,000 new settler units in the occupied West Bank. President Mahmoud Abbas's office rejected the move, saying it contradicted the U.S. position President Joe Biden expressed in a call with his Palestinian counterpart. The Palestinian foreign ministry also condemned the move as aimed at grabbing more Palestinian land and consolidating Israel's settler colonialism. The regime's new plans come despite international criticism against its settlement expansions. In July, a UN human rights investigator said Israeli settlement activity in the occupied West Bank amounts to a war crime. All Israeli settlements are deemed illegal under international law. To discuss this issue a little bit further, I'm going to bring in dear guests from Ramallah. Amal Wahdan joins us. She's an activist and out of London via Skype. Professor Ken Farrow, he is the professor of media and philosophy. Professor, it's always good to have you with us on the show. I'm going to begin, I guess, with Madame Wahdan in Ramallah itself to perhaps get her reaction on this latest series of settlement building. I'm sorry to say that this is not news, really, of Israelis wanting to build settler units in those areas. But, you know, the fact that they keep going on despite, you know, the UN reports, the condemnations, and, you know, still going with impunity, I guess that is the issue of significance here. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, yeah, sure. Of course, this doesn't need only condemnation by the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas. It needs more actions on the ground first, and he needs to exert more pressure diplomatically, politically, and in the UN Security Council as well. we can go as far as the ICC, since all these war crimes must be fought and must be stood against. Now they are. This is a new wave, actually, of attacking the essential part of the Palestinian state. You know, it, Mahmoud Abbas believes that with the two-state solution. So this endangers even his vision for a two-state solution. It's actually taking most of the land. We only have like 10% of the land if we take out the sea areas, what they call sea areas under the Oslo Accords. This means that he's Mahmoud Abbas is going to be a president on a 10% of the historic site, you know, historic Palestine. And if we look at what's going on in Jerusalem, in Sheikh Jarrah, and in Silwan, and the settlement, the land settlement project, this means that the Palestinian state again is going to be without its capital in East Jerusalem. So actually, the president is losing everything on the ground, and he keeps doing the same thing that he used to do. And this is not acceptable. He needs to escalate the popular resistance, as he prefers to go ahead in fighting the colonialism project in the West Bank. He needs to also increase or change his tone towards the USA. The USA actually keeps giving us promises, empty words, but they're not going to exert any pressure against the Israelis, and they will keep covering up their crimes.
Yeah, on those empty words notes, I'm just going to hand it over to Professor Farrow in London. Professor, what do you think about this? You know, the fact that President Abbas has condemned this. You know, I sometimes wonder what cards does he have to play, really, other than these words. And, you know, the like he or his office says, you know, that the fact that the conversation that he has had with Joe Biden, with Joe Biden, really was something otherwise, you know, and you know, the result is coming out totally different. What do you think?
Well, I don't think you can consider the destination of a people based on the conversation between Abbas and Biden. I think the issue here, and I completely agree with my colleague in terms of the need to take these issues to the International Criminal Court, because these are war crimes. And more than that, this is the continuing ethnic cleansing of Palestine. People need to remember that in 1948, 80% of the population, of the Palestinian population of Palestine, were displaced or fled, 80%. And since then, the remaining 20% and people in exile have been pushed around. I mean, Abbas is in between a rock and a hard place, but he's losing the rock and the hard place. And I think we're in a position now internationally where there really has to be much more pressure. And I'm quite hopeful in terms of the situation with international attention on Palestine, particularly from young people, and particularly their political position in terms of the rejection of the two-state solution, which we're getting a lot of information on from around the world, not just in Palestine and the Middle East, but internationally as well. So I think these are important developments that need to be encouraged. So I think a focus on war crimes at the International Criminal Court, and also the escalation of international pressure on Israel to not just stop these plans, but to roll back what's happened before, and to go much, much further, as people are suggesting.
Professor Ken Farrow, Professor of Media and Philosophy out of London via Skype. Thank you very much. Madame Amal Wahdan, Palestinian activist in Ramallah, thank you very much as well for participating in this discussion. China has rejected the World Health Organization's calls for a renewed probe into the origins of COVID-19. Beijing says the calls are politically motivated. On Thursday, the WHO urged China to share raw data from the earliest COVID cases to revive its probe into the origins of the disease. The organization carried out a first investigation in January when its team visited the Chinese city of Wuhan. That's where the first global infections emerged. In its report, the WHO said it was, quote, extremely unlikely that a lab leak caused the pandemic, but it failed to conclude how the virus began. Now, China says that same report should be the basis of a future global traceability work. Russia has recorded 815 new deaths from COVID-19, the highest daily fatality rate since the pandemic began. The latest figure brings to over 168,000 the number of total virus deaths in Russia. The health ministry also announced more than 22,200 new daily cases on Friday. Russia's been grappling with a third wave of the disease since mid-June. The authorities blamed the resurgence on the highly contagious Delta variant. 42% of the Russian population has been fully vaccinated, but independent polls show that 55% of Russians do not plan on getting a jab. Australia's state of New South Wales has reported its biggest daily rise of coronavirus cases since the start of the pandemic. Officials warned that infections could surge in the coming days.
We had, unfortunately, 390 cases of community transmission. Some are still under investigation, but at least 60 of those have been infectious in the community. And I anticipate, given the large number of cases we've had in the last few days, that unfortunately this trend will continue for at least the next few days.
The authorities also reported two new deaths. They bring to 38 total fatalities from the latest outbreak in New South Wales. The state's capital, Sydney, is the hardest hit. Infections have spiked there despite a nearly seven-week lockdown. The restrictions were imposed after a Delta-driven outbreak in the city in mid-June. The virus has even spread to other parts of Australia, prompting officials to impose similar curves. On Friday, the capital, Canberra, entered its first day of a week-long lockdown after it reported two cases. The lockdown is the first there in more than a year.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Today. Methods and people may change, but the goals and the framework are fixed. A senior lawmaker, Amui, said this in reference to the Rouhani-Raisi transition and the fate of the JCPOA. Indeed, the new Iranian president, Raisi, did pledge to get international sanctions lifted, as he pledged to improve ties with neighboring countries and unite the country's political factions. And he realizes the straight path to sanctions relief is the revival of the JCPOA, or Iran nuclear deal, signed in 2015 under former President Rouhani, a moderate. But the new principalists in office may take a harder stance in verifying U.S. good faith and sanctions relief before leading the country into full recommitment to the deal. For a look at Iran's 13th government and how it may steer the JCPOA, with the U.S. steering in the opposite direction at times, stay with me, Leila Faromarzi, on Iran Today. JCPOA revival talks in Vienna began in April, but are suspended for weeks as they go on to a seventh round, because Iran is in a state of transition as a new government takes hold. It's been called a state of suspended animation, as talks will pick up to go one of two ways. According to most foreign media outlets, the way for them to go is for Iran to return to commitments to the deal or to surrender to U.S. demand. Feel free to call it hilarious, as Iran never left the deal. Mr. Ghaffari explains who is legally and logically liable with a look at provisions in the JCPOA or Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action itself. He is a senior writer on Jame Jam Daily, who received us amid Journalist Day celebrations at his paper. That would be on the 8th of August. World media tends to point the finger at Iran. Iran must recommit to the JCPOA, but it wasn't Iran that left the JCPOA to begin with. Do make a point of this.
We're currently a member of the JCPOA, but the US isn't. This makes matters more clear. A former member who has withdrawn from participation in the deal must meet some very clear preconditions. The preconditions have been communicated to the American side during six rounds of talks in Vienna, indirectly by Washington's European allies, as well as China and Russia. These include issues such as providing a guarantee about the future of the JCPOA, verification of the US return to the deal, guarantees about the removal of all sanctions under the agreement, and the cooperation with the IAEA about Iran's research and development program in the field of peaceful nuclear technology. These are technical and legal matters that have been explained fully to the American side.
The US began passing laws in breach of the JCPOA right after its signing. Then later, on May the 8th, 2018, former US President Trump binned the deal and accused Iran of lying. Just the following day, the international nuclear watchdog chief noted again that Iran is meeting the terms of the agreement. Even the then U.S. Secretary of State himself, Mike Pompeo, admitted that there was no evidence Iran was in violation of the agreement. It bears the conclusion there was no legitimate basis for Trump to pull out and reimpose sanctions. By today, the nuclear watchdog, or IAEA, has confirmed 16 times that Iran was and is in full compliance with the deal. Iran signed the deal with six world powers for relief from economic, nuclear-related UN sanctions against this country. This would help it boost its oil exports and economy, and in return, Iran would limit its nuclear program. But Trump unilaterally pulled out of the nuclear deal and reimposed and reinforced UN sanctions, now as US sanctions, rooting for bringing our oil sales down to zero. Iran waited a year for Europeans to execute a way round what was now US sanctions, but to no avail. Seems pretty obvious in whose field the ball is. But common sense and right and wrong aside, how do the prospects of the Vienna talks look practically? Mr. Amoui is spokesman for the Parliamentary National Security Committee. We got to meet him at his private office. How much prospect do you see for a JCPOA revival? In whose field is the ball?
The question of whether the JCPOA can be revived as a limited and substantive agreement must be answered by the Americans. Iran is still a party to the deal. It has reduced its commitments to the accord using one of the mechanisms cited inside the very same deal. But the American side has withdrawn its participation from it. If they believe that Iran must go back to full compliance and scale back its response, they have to fulfill Tehran's demand, which is the removal of sanctions.
Whatever the present situation and prospects of talks, their very existence means the JCPOA, a deal between Iran and the West, is still on the table. That is a pure example of contradiction with the fact that the West has tried to topple Iran's greater government time and again.
For example, the American side has stated that a clause should be included in the JCPOA revival agreement that would stipulate we must enter into negotiations over our regional issues and missile defense matters in a few months with the United States and Europe. Here we have a legal argument. We are saying that if you consider the JCPOA as an independent legal variable, we shouldn't tie it to other matters. If you don't, there's no need to talk about being committed to the multilateral agreement anyway. This is a paradox. that must be resolved by the American officials themselves.
In facing triple challenges and triple challenges times three, with an economy resisting but suffering U.S. sanctions, paired with the corona crisis and drought and dried up rivers, Raisi has the opportunity of a fresh start. To his inauguration ceremony of 5th August 2021 came senior officials from East and West. The European Union, for one, sent a senior delegation that included Enrique Mora, one of the coordinators of the nuclear talks. On the other hand, leaders of the Palestinian resistance group Hamas and Lebanon's Hezbollah were in attendance. And some attendees took the opportunity to hold talks with Iranian officials on the sidelines of the ceremony. America's partners in the nuclear deal, the biggest of whom are the Western Europeans, rejected Trump's plan to use sanctions to coerce Iran into accepting new terms upon his pullout over 3 years ago. And Iran agreed to adhere to the terms of the agreement. But if the EU, Russia, and China could deliver economic incentives, the Europeans, in contrast to America, understood that Trump's violation of the deal would undermine broader efforts to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons, although they have themselves practically followed in the US footsteps up to a point. I did ask whether it wouldn't be a better policy for Iran to go it step for step with the US, but it's not easy to blame this country for wanting to verify a full removal of sanctions before recommitting. That's to say, before scaling down its peaceful nuclear program, which it's entitled to under the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which Iran is party to. This country will no longer accept U.S. excuses that it has to impose long-term sanctions on Iran because of this or that law. Laws that are all in violation of Article 29 of the deal. Say the Iran Sanctions Act, ISA, and visa and U-turn regulations, and the Qatsa law, given as everyone knows that big companies are not willing to invest in a country for 6 months or less duration. Qatsa stands for Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act. Right and wrong aside, realistically looking at the bigger picture, where do you see JCPOA Vienna talks leading? Do you see the JCPOA being revived?
Regardless of the flaws, ambiguities, and the nature of the agreement, it was legally ratified by all permanent and non-permanent members of the UN Security Council as a common ground based on multilateralism in the international system. And the UN Resolution 2231 was issued to enshrine the deal. Well, here, if we want to step back from this definitive document and put a step-by-step approach on the agenda, it means that we have disregarded a strong agreement.
Right after the JCPOA became operational, its implementation was not perfect. In early 2016, the U.S. Congress passed, by veto-proof majorities, legislation that required Europeans and others who had traveled to Iran to get visas to go to the U.S. This negatively affected Iran's ability to attract Western investors. Mr. Qaderi is a political analyst and journalist of long standing, an old pen, so to speak. Let's hear him out.
I call it economic terrorism or scientific terrorism in the sense that you have banned our scientists too. Why have you denied our scientists access so they can build what they need inside the country? We face this problem. Especially during the coronavirus pandemic, they didn't allow Iran access to the WHO's international COVAX vaccine basket, even though Iran had paid for the jabs in advance and was in line to receive them. This ugly behavior was exhibited for other countries too.
Iran demands the U.S. must, in accordance with Article 29 of the JCPOA, lift all the obstacles in the way of normalizing Iran's trade ties with world countries. It must lift all sanctions imposed under any title after the JCPOA took effect, whether during the term of Trump or that of his predecessor, Barack Obama. And all the JCPOA articles should be precisely implemented. Plenty more on the result of Trump and Congress's actions and how Raisi might handle them. But first, allow me to introduce Sarah to the show for a quick media review.
Hello and welcome to the news part of the show with me, Sarah Adema. Today I'm going to walk you through different media outlets and their reviews regarding the JCPOA, or the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Let's get right into it. Our first piece of news comes from Tehran Times. That begins with the headline, Iran says JCPOA is not over. Khatibzadeh, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman, at his press briefing, which was held online, responded to some statement made inside the United States that Washington should not allow the new Iranian president and his entourage to attend the United Nations General Assembly in New York. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman stated, the U.S. government must take into account that it has definitive hosting responsibilities for the United Nations headquarters in New York. And regardless of its differences with countries, it has specific hosting responsibilities and must act within the framework. He also responded to another question regarding remarks by the U.S. Secretary of State and some European countries that the JCPOA talks will not remain open for a long time and that Iran have delayed the Vienna talks, saying, as a country that has caused many troubles in a criminal economic war against the Iranian nation, the United States is not in a position to talk about these issues. Khatibzadeh said, such a speculation that the nuclear negotiations have been concluded will not help the issue. On to another review by Meh News Agency, they say, Iran may return to Vienna talks with unrealistic demands. New York Times reported, the U.S. Special Representative for Iran's Affairs, Robert Malley, claimed that Iran may return to the seventh round of nuclear talks in Vienna with unrealistic demands. Robert Malley said, there is a real risk that they come back with unrealistic demands about what they can achieve in these talks. Meanwhile, a senior European official involved in Vienna talks said that if U.S. President Joe Biden is not elected for the next term, or a person like former U.S. President Trump is elected, there is a possibility that the United States will withdraw from Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. He added, if this event has happened once, it can be repeated again. Many observers believe that U.S. President Joe Biden is continuing former U.S. President Donald Trump's policy of maximum pressure on Iran. Our final piece of news is from Middle East Eye, which reads, U.S. urges Iran's Raisi to restart nuclear talks amid tensions over ship attack. The United States has urged Iran's new president to return to talks on the resumption of the 2015 nuclear deal, warning that the window for diplomacy would not stay open forever. State Department spokesman Ned Price told reporters that he hoped incoming President Ebrahim Raisi seizes the opportunity now to advance diplomatic solutions. Price said, we are waiting to see, as I've mentioned before, the approach that the new government in Iran will take. He added, for our part, we have made very clear that we are prepared to return to Vienna to resume negotiations. Iran initially continued to abide by the deal, but has reduced some of its commitments in recent months. During his swearing-in ceremony, Raisi said broad U.S. sanctions, which had triggered an economic recession and left inflation hovering at around 40%, must be lifted. We will support any diplomatic plans that will achieve this goal. He said this while signaling a willingness to attend future negotiations in Vienna. That's it for me in today's edition. Back to you, Leila.
Talking of lawmaking and U.S. Congress, how would Iranians react? How have they reacted to congressional rejection of the JCPOA and U.S. efforts to strengthen sanctions? Well, by maintaining full commitment for a year, Iran has discredited America. And since reacting to Western inaction in executing the deal, it has gotten to bring its nuclear program back to life to increase nuclear capacity at a time when it would escape any criticism for doing so. Never mind the fact that the program is peaceful. The West is not sure of that.
You see, naturally, the media represent different political camps and can't be assessed and evaluated from a single point of view. Some media outlets are hostile to the Islamic Republic, whose agenda we all know. Persian-speaking media that are receiving substantial budgets from our enemies, intelligence services. The others are the mainstream media in the West, which have unfortunately violated their personal practices repeatedly in the past few years. Generally, it appears that Western media is being managed against Iran, which can't be looked at optimistically.
What entity exactly is Iran faced with? A unified U.S., U.S. Congress, the U.S. government?
I can confidently say that we don't recognize anything in international law other than the government. The American side, which comes forth for talks with Iran and participates in P5+1 meetings, must represent the entirety of the U.S. political establishment. The fact that they face limitations at home limits their negotiation power. But we don't accept that they commit to something that they would later say the U.S. government can't fulfill.
Iran started to partially reduce its commitments to the JCPOA in 2019 in accordance with paragraph 36 of the multilateral agreement. Paragraph 36 allows one side to stop complying with the deal if the other side is out of compliance. All being said, if sanctions are lifted, Iran will immediately reverse its decisions and enhancing its nuclear program.
It was within the same framework that Iran took steps to scale back its commitment to the deal a year after unilaterally staying committed to the accord. Tehran devised five steps that would reduce its commitments with prior notice. But in January 2020, there was a new development, the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani by the U.S. Iran, however, didn't take any new steps until a new parliament came into office. The new parliament has confronted the nuclear issue carefully since taking office. After a few months, Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was assassinated. Iran's parliament, that planned on activating the nuclear program, devised a guideline as a law to kickstart the issue in response to the destructive attitude of foreign parties. The law saw Iran starting uranium enrichment to a 20% purity level and the suspension of the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol.
Looking at how things are, Iran has actually gained strategic depth in deepening its partnership with Russia and China. Now it is neither possible to isolate Iran nor prudent to exercise the military option against this country. FATF anti-money laundering regulations were a condition for engaging the West in business, as was to be facilitated by the JCPOA. Our guest explains why Iran couldn't simply accept the condition.
The FATF is an international working group to fight money laundering and funding terrorism. We certainly agree that terrorist groups should not be financially supported. We oppose money laundering. We have strong laws on this issue. We also have strong regulations in the fight against terrorism. But in the last round of talks between Iran and the FATF working group, 41 commitments were made to Iran to cooperate with the group. We carried out 39 of them. There are two issues left, which are the working group's insistence that Iran accedes to the Palermo Convention and the Terrorism Financial Convention, and in that context, to make our financial banking transactions transparent. What is the reason? Due to sanctions, we are working with various foreign companies and different banks in non-transparent ways. This means that our business partners do not want their names to be announced on these issues because of the sanctions and the pressure that the United States is unilaterally putting on them.
Sounds like the U.S. will simply have to accept its simple obligation of sanctions removal before things get a-going. A simple formula for Vienna talks to succeed in getting the JCPOA back on track after 3 years since its derailing by Trump. It was just another instance of childish fits by Trump, who'd made it a habit to break contracts his predecessor had made.
The important point is that the party that has officially and publicly left the JCPOA in front of the cameras of the international media now wants to return to it at the lowest cost so that it can serve its interests. This is important because if the Americans are willing to fulfill their commitments now, we have two issues that remain unresolved. One is the damage done to Iran after the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA, and the other is the issue of whether they will stay committed. We saw recently that Antony Blinken insisted, and even Jake Sullivan confirmed in another interview, that there would be no guarantees the commitments would last.
At best, Iran once again faces the dilemma of negotiating a deal with an uncertain shelf life. The relatively new, seemingly level-headed U.S. President Biden actually hopes to realize the key objectives that the Trump administration pursued and failed to achieve through its maximum pressure strategy. One of those objectives is an updated version of the 2015 agreement that would almost permanently prohibit Iran from exercising its prerogative to conduct a peaceful nuclear program under the NPT as a non-nuclear weapon state such as Japan or Brazil.
The Biden administration took office with the slogan that we are not Trump and we want to turn things around. It's facing pressure from the international community, which in my opinion is a result of their wrong behavior. But in any case, they need more than the Islamic Republic of Iran to reach a deal, so they can show it off to the world as a victory. We even heard some stories that Naftali Bennett is instructed not to escalate the tensions beyond the point of no return. This shows that they want to maintain the pressure up to a certain point so they can make Iran accept the new conditions in the talks.
How might Iran verify U.S. honesty and commitment to the JCPOA if it is revived?
The need for a body that can verify whether the sanctions are lifted completely is quite clear. And therefore, we think the most significant party that can give us this report is the Iranian side itself. Iran can report to those who do business with Iran, which are very diverse partners, including companies and various governments that want to do business with Iran, whether they face sanctions or obstacles in the implementation of their work or not. Iran can report this. One of our demands in the Vienna talks was that there should be a thorough verification process. To issue only a declaration that, for example, Iran is free to sell its oil may not necessarily be accurate in practice, because until we test this, we cannot accurately say that the problem of oil sales is completely solved.
America may aspire. But Iran or its leader Ayatollah Khamenei flatly rejected the insertion of any other issues into the deal. His remarks are an indicator of how Raisi will approach the Vienna negotiations when they resume. Anyhow, by whichever partner or partners goodwill and courage in the face of U.S. threats the JCPOA might be revived, strengthened ties between Iran and Europe alone will boost security in this tip of Eurasia, as well as trade lost rather than increased.
My prediction is that the West won't lift sanctions, at least in the short and medium term. The reason is quite clear. Even if they do sign and retest the process, they take attitudes against Iran that give off negative messages to international businesses and economic firms that would deter them from making investments in Iran. This is completely clear, even if it doesn't appear on paper and stays unspoken.
And that'll be all for today, but the best is yet to come, with talks resuming to put all theory to test. So do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after. Thanks from the whole team, and bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Muharram. Times of sadness have.
As-salamu alayk ya Aba Abdullah.
As-salamu alayk ya Rasul Allah. Ana al-Husayn ibn Fatima.
The words of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam in dialogue, a special program for the month of Muharram.
Sallallahu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Casting gloom on Karbala, casting gloom on Karbala.
Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, the son of the commander of the faithful Imam Ali, the son of the Lady of Light, the esteemed Fatima, and the grandson of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, the beacon of light which guides towards chivalry and courage, the one who addresses Allah the Mighty on the day of Ashura, saying, "You are my power and certainty in everything that happens to me and whatever befalls me." Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, the master of martyrs, these are his words. Imam al-Husayn's words in response to Lady Salama.
قال الإمام الحسين عليه السلام يا أما وأنا أعلم أني مقتول مذبوح ظلما وعدوانا وقد شاء عز وجل أن يرى حرمي ورهتي مشردين وأطفالي مذبوحين مأسورين مقيدين وهم يستغيثون فلا يجدون ناصرا.
O dear mother, I am aware that I shall be slain out of animosity, and the Almighty Allah has wanted to see my family members dispersed, and my children slain and captivated, bound by chains while they are crying and appealing for help, but they do not find any helper.
As-salamu alayka ya asir al-qurbat. As-salamu السلام عليك يا أسير الكربات ويا قتيل العبرات السلام عليك يا أسير الكربات ويا قتيل العبرات أترجو أمتي قتلت حسينا شفاعة جده يوم الحساب السلام على الخد التريب
And now let's listen to Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبه نستعين صلى الله عليك يا أبا عبد الله. As soon as Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam intended to leave Medina for Mecca, Umm Salama, who was a widow of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, rushed out and tried to stop Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, because Umm Salama had heard it directly from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, not once or twice but many times, that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam would certainly be martyred. Then when Umm Salama reached Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam addressed him as Ya Ummah, O my dear mother. It indicates that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam loved Umm Salama quite a lot, because Umm Salama was a widow of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, a widow who used to be very much respected by the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And at the same time, we find that Umm Salama did her best in favor of Imam al-Hasan, Imam al-Hussein, and Zainab al-Kubra. We find that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam stressed and indicated that he was certainly aware of his own martyrdom fate, contrary to some interpretations of some people who may say that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was caught by martyrdom fate. At least the very fragment indicates that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was certainly aware of his own martyrdom fate, yet being informed 100% sure of his own martyrdom fate wouldn't cause Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam to hesitate in the sacred path he had chosen to follow. It indicates that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was not only informed of his own martyrdom fate, but he informed Umm Salama that he was very much sure that after his martyrdom, his family members would certainly be captivated. Sallallahu alayk, Ya Aba Abdullah. Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Dialogue. We hope that you remain under the auspicious grace of Imam Hussein today and always. عليك مني
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.